Welcome to the Great Trials Podcast, where you get a behind-the-scenes look at America's greatest trials with the trial lawyers who tried them.
What are our shared values and common beliefs? And that's where lawyers get in trouble. They don't keep that in mind when you're talking to a jury. You know, like I cross-examined an accident reconstructionist one time. He said, you know, it's a second and a half perception reaction. I said, really? How long does it take for a baseball to get from the pitcher's mound to the catcher's mitt? You know, like a third of a second. How does anybody ever hit the ball? You know, the jurors don't just automatically accept everything that lawyers think is fact.
Please rise. Court is now in session.
All right. Welcome to the Great Trials Podcast. This is Steve Lowry with Yvonne Godfrey. Yvonne, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I just want to mention really quickly that I did call Raz Razzle Dazzle right before we started recording, and he didn't say anything about it. And I don't know if that's because he was offended or if he likes it.
I thought that was pretty good. I thought that was a pretty good nickname for Raz, but
only you, Yvonne. Just you.
I don't know how. That's right. I don't know how long. Why it took me so long to call you Razzle Dazzle?
Yeah, that's right.
But I'm not stopping now.
I'm
anyway,
offended.
How are you,
Steve? I can't call you Razzle Dazzle, Raz.
I don't know, Steve. I don't know how close do you want to get?
Yeah, that's right. I am good, Yvonne. I'm good. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm excited.
Yes, me too. And I should just mention that we have. I don't think we're going to hear from him, but somebody wanted to watch a little bit and wanted to let our listeners know that Bob Poston from Legal Technology Services is watching. And as everybody knows, Legal Technology Services is one of our great sponsors of the show, so we thought it'd be all right for him to watch.
It's like having the principal sit in on your class.
Yeah, exactly. He's sitting there with his computer muted. I didn't know if he wanted to say hi or not.
Hello, Steve and Yvonne. How are you?
Good, Bob. How are you?
I'm just downstairs watching. Good to see you. Matt, good to see you. Jane.
Yeah, I feel like I'm at trial again, Bob.
That's right.
A bunch of our video stuff and always great job for us. So
if the listeners could only sit in on one of our prep sessions with Bob, where it's basically constantly yelling at Bob for why aren't you doing this?
That's true. I'm meaner to Bob during trial prep than I am to anybody else in my entire life.
Gonna be a long day tomorrow.
That's right. We're doing it tomorrow. So good times.
Yeah. The truth is, LTS and Bob and Liz and everybody over there are all fantastic. And that's why we love to use them. And that's why we have them as a sponsor on the show. But, let me go ahead and introduce our two great guests. So, not only are these guys both fantastic trial lawyers, they've got a lot of stuff in common. Both of them are in Gainesville, Georgia. Both of them are graduates from the class of 1999 of Mercer Law. And both of them have been on the show before. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce Matt Cook and Shane Lazenby. How are you guys doing?
Doing well, guys. I appreciate y'all having us on and being here again.
Doing great. Thanks so much.
Well, it's so good to have you on, and let me go ahead and introduce, go ahead and give a little bit of background just so everybody knows who we're talking about. Shane, I'll start with you. So Shane Lazenby is the founder of the Lazenby Law Group in Gainesville, Georgia. You can look him up at lazlawgroup.com. That's lazlawgroup.com. I almost spelled law for everybody. So, as I said, he was a graduate of the Mercer Law School class of 1999, along with his classmate Matt, and along with our partner here, Jeff Harris. And he was on the Mercer Law Review. Shane was in the U.S. Army for a while, was a judge advocate with the 82nd Airborne, was counsel for the commander of the 3rd Battalion overseas, and you had a number of decorations and honors from the Army, Shane. I won't go through all those, but there's a lot of them, and on top of that, Shane's just a great guy, fantastic trial lawyer. We've had him on the show before, and as I was looking at his his CV. I saw that his wrongful death verdict of 2020 was the highest verdict in Georgia, and that was the $21 million verdict that we talked about on this show. So, Shane, great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Steve. I sure appreciate y'all having me. Yeah, that 2020 verdict, I'm proud of it, but it helped that COVID sort of shut down the court for the last 10 months.
Right. Exactly. You got the good verdict, and then everything else shut down. But exactly. I don't know. That's still a pretty good verdict, and would be hard to beat either way. Absolutely. Our other guest is Matt Cook. Matt's been on the show before, and Matt is the founding partner at Cook Law Group. And you can look him up at cook-lawgroup.com, just in case you need to know. Cook is COOK. And Matt is also a fantastic trial lawyer, has also a member of the Mercer Law Review, received numerous honors while in law school, and has just done great work as a trial lawyer. Speaks all over the country on trial tactics, and has also been on the show before for his good work trying cases. So, Matt, it's great to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
Also, yeah. A barbecue expert. Yes. I don't know if you meant to leave that out, Steve.
But I should have put that on. We were just talking ahead of time that Yvonne's getting ready to drive down to Savannah from Atlanta, and she's going to have to go through Macon. And as most people know, I think that Mercer's in Macon. So Matt and Shane were talking about maybe some good places to eat on the way down.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, you really can't keep a body like this without eating barbecue pretty frequently.
Right. That's right.
That's right. A lot of work.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's talk about this case that the two of you tried together. The name of the case is Peyton Freeman on behalf of his mother, Talia Freeman, through his grandparents, Sandra and Patrick Gallo, and also Stephen Haynes, were the plaintiffs in this case, and the defendants were Ace American Insurance Company, C&T Durham Trucking Company, Randall Trice, and Joaquin Nomura. It was tried in February of this year, 2024, in DeKalb County. And we don't know what the verdict would have been, because after the closing argument, then the defense decided to cave and settled the case for $10 million. So a damn good settlement. And I think that's because they knew what must have been coming after watching the jury. The facts of the case are that back in, I think it was April 23rd of 2016 or April 22nd of 2016, I was just looking at this, Stephen Haynes was driving north on I-85 with his cousin Talia Freeman in the passenger seat. It was about 4:40 a.m. They're heading north on I-85 at just south of Pleasant Hill Road, and a truck, a tractor trailer that was being driven by Mr. Trice on behalf of C&T Durham Trucking was also driving north, and there was some dispute over this, Mr. Trice tried to make a change into or move to the left into the lane that was already occupied by Stephen Haynes and Talia Freeman, and hit the rear of their vehicle, caused them to spin out of control. And as I understand it, their vehicle was essentially sitting broadside when it came to rest, sitting broadside facing towards the median, and the headlights were out. And as Talia and Stephen were trying to get out of the vehicle, another vehicle, a minivan driven by Mr. Nomura, came and hit them broadside and killed Talia Freeman almost instantly, and injured Mr. Haynes, who survived and who was represented by separate counsel in this case. Matt and Shane represented the family of Talia Freeman, and specifically her six-year-old son, Peyton, who she was, from what I understand, she was the, she was a single mom. I mean, she was the one raising him. So essentially Peyton lost his parents in this. And so, so Talia, so the case got tried, in 2024, and, the defense, as I understand it, was basically trying to argue that the truck, was in its lane and that, Stephen and Talia moved into the truck's lane and were the actual cause of the, collision. And then, basically tried to argue that they, instead of getting off of the highway, just kind of hung around the vehicle, Talia, claiming that Talia was trying to get her purse out, and that so they essentially caused this collision, didn't get out of the roadway fast enough, and that Mr. Nomura caused the collision by not watching out. But as I said, after trying the case for 6 days in DeKalb County, the case resolved for $10 million. And prior to that point, I think the highest offer they had ever made was $1.5 million. Is that right, guys?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, you know, and it was a long journey in this case. The restoration of Notre Dame and this case are the two longest running projects on the face of the earth right now. But, you know, we actually tried this case, half tried it in August. So we started it in August. One of the lawyers for the co-plaintiff came down with COVID. So the case was continued. And then after about a month, another person got COVID. And so the court mistried it and said, you know, we can't have a jury held up here for a month and a half. So we got reset. So it was a long journey for us.
Yeah. Well, so talk about that a little bit. I mean, so this is a 2016 collision and you're trying the case in 2024. I mean, even if you tried it in 2023, seems like it takes a while. And it was a lot of that due to COVID, or was it other factors, or what was going on with it?
Well, some of that, I mean, we didn't get the case right away. You know, the case had been passed around through a couple of lawyers, and it came in and everybody was really stumped over what had happened. It was like a who ran the red light with no witnesses, you know?
Right.
The issue was who changed lanes. And the driver of our car didn't know, because he'd been through a traumatic event, saw his cousin die before his eyes, broke his leg. It happens in a moment, you know, just a matter of a few seconds. So it didn't get to us right away. Basically, about a year after the wreck had happened, we got involved and started to unwind it and, you know, kind of solved the puzzle from the puzzle pieces we had that some other folks had overlooked, including the investigating officer. And then we got it ready for trial, and we were ready in February of 2020 with a trial date. And then everybody knows what happened. COVID hit. And so we were on hold, and we were reset for February of 23 or so. And the DeKalb County Courthouse flooded.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
And we were off until August, and then, you know, COVID strikes again, we get mistried, and long journey. And when you remove thinking about our schedules and, you know, the court's schedule, what you got to think about is what's going on for Miss Gallo, Miss Freeman's mother, who, you know, stood in for Peyton, her grandson. She's going 6 or 7 Thanksgivings with no money, no relief, no acknowledgement of fault. 6 or 7 Christmases the same way. You know, what do you tell her as the lawyer? You know, I'm sorry, you know, there's divorce cases going or what have you, not in state court, but, you know, there's DUI court and all that. So it's a tough journey when you go that long.
Yeah, no doubt. Yes, so you talked briefly, Matt, there about that there was some, it took a little bit to figure out what happened here. And my understanding is that was there some eyewitness testimony that was not favorable, but the physical evidence showed otherwise? Is that what it was?
Yeah, the eyewitness testimony actually from the driver of our car was unfavorable to us in a way. It was confused. It wasn't. He ultimately didn't know what happened, and he'd made multiple statements to insurance adjusters and doctors trying to put in place some explanation for what happened. But ultimately, you know, went through the pictures of the roadway, Google Earth, pictures of the vehicles, scans of the vehicles, and it really sort of went on like a light bulb. There was two marks in the lane where these vehicles came together, and there was witness marks on both the truck and the Expedition. And when you put those together, for a moment in time, you knew exactly where everybody was. And when you put that together, and then we had it drawn by Jeff Kidd, who did a really good job for us, accident reconstructionist. When you set that Expedition down over those witness marks in the pavement, and you put the tractor trailer on top of the Expedition, like we knew it went together, then it was crystal clear. And from that moment forward, we knew what our case was. But for years, we litigated with the other side. And their attempts to run from what was plain as day went from absurd to infuriating, ultimately, at trial. And their refusal to acknowledge what was obvious, you know, as usual, was like pouring gas on a fire. And the jury did not appreciate that. And by the end of opening, I handled the liability side. Shane handled the damages side. We kind of split it up that way. And, you know, their accident reconstructionist came in with a half-baked theory, which gave me 3 hours of cross-exam, which I think is so pivotal in most cases, because you not only get to prove the absurdity, but the meanness of the defense. And we use that in closing, you know. Again, just told the jury, you know, this isn't about objections. It's not about legal terms. It's not about pictures and reconstruction terms. It's about the big picture. And the defense is it's isn't a game. It's just cruel. And it's cruel when you do this to a six-year-old. And keep in mind the big picture. And that's what we told them, you know. And they do it all for what? Money? For notching their belt for another win? And so I think the jury really saw it not on a sympathy basis as much as they did, you know, a frustration and a frivolous defense. So.
Yeah, it really was. And I will share with you, Stephen Yvonne, some of the things I noticed about Matt's handling of the case. And it was picked up by Courtroom Viewer Network, and it would be worth the watch to watch his cross-examination of their expert, a fellow by the name of Darren Marceau, because it was just a total dismantling of his theories in the case. And it was impressive to watch because, like Matt said, I handled the damages part and he handled the liability part. So I was largely a spectator on that portion of the case. And it was impressive. It really was.
How I'm just curious, how was he able to or how did he try to explain the physical marks that are on the roadway that, you know, seem to suggest exactly where everybody is?
He really went with a you can't prove it case. You know, I don't know what those marks are. He said that could be from anything. That's from I-85. You know, I mean, we're on I-85. How do you know it wasn't someone else, you know, that left those marks? I mean, couldn't it just be the biggest coincidence in the world that those marks exactly match the Expedition and exactly where they were in the orientation? So his position was that to a great extent. Secondly, he didn't scratch the surface because he preferred the willful blindness of his approach. And, you know, maybe for summary judgment, poking holes in somebody's burden or theory works. But I'll tell you what, if you're defending a case for a 32-year-old dead lady, you better get up and bring something more than I don't know. Literally, they said in opening, we don't have to prove a thing. We could sit over here and play on our computers. I would never let that come out of my mouth if I was on the side. And that's what they did. You know, it was interesting. But we were able to use all that very effectively against them, I think.
All right. So, Yvonne, it's always good to be prepared at trial, right?
Right.
And who can always help you be prepared and your best at trial?
Without a doubt, Legal Technology Services.
That's right. And you can look them up at legal LegalTechService.com. That's LegalTech, T-E-C-H, service.com. And they are just fantastic at trial. Our firm has used them for every trial that we've been to. They're fantastic, always prepared, always helpful. You can say hello to Bob, Melanie, Liz, or Patrick, or any of the other people in their team. But LegalTechnologyServices.com, they can help you not only with your technology at trial, they can help you with day in the life videos, they can help you with mediation settlement videos, they can help you with demonstratives, even including, I one time had them build me a model of a panel that was, I think, 12 feet long by 10 feet tall that had fallen on our client and shattered his leg. And they built one for me that I could use in the courtroom. So they're fantastic. Please go to Legal Technology Services, and that's LegalTechService.com.
Well, you know, one of the things I noticed, and you know, so since you guys settled this case, we don't have the transcripts, although I would love to have seen the cross, but I am just in looking at the pre-trial, I can tell they were also just trying to imply certain things about what they have been doing. Like, for instance, when they write that just before midnight on April 22nd, 2016, Haynes and Freeman drove roughly 50 miles in a Ford Expedition to a late night establishment and dance club called Club 426 in Stone Mountain. And then we're heading back home at 4 a.m. So suggesting that alcohol or, you know, maybe even something else is involved. What was there any evidence of that, or was that just all pure suggestion?
Absolutely no evidence whatsoever. And Matt did a good job of pointing that out very early on. And I'll tell you, you know, a lot of times in these cases, we do our best to represent our clients well, but a lot of times mistakes of the other side that you capitalize on end up being some of your best friends. One of the things the defense did in this case is they put together an animation that they never vetted through their own expert. And so when the expert's on cross-examination, first of all, he characterized the animation as a cartoon. And so Matt continually reminded him that this was a cartoon, which is somewhat of a buzzword. But also, he had never affirmed that the animation accurately represented what he contended the facts to be. And so that really hurt him bad. And at one point, the defense counsel even said that it was not intended to be approved by him or words to that effect, which really calls into doubt their, integrity with regard to what they're presenting to the jury. And we think the jury didn't appreciate it very much.
So wait, so I have to know, when you asked him about it, you know, when you asked the expert about it, did you know what he was going to say, or were you just curious what he was going to say about it?
Well, we had deposed him, and they had produced the animation, and it was the seventh version when we got it. And so we had an opportunity to redepose him on the issue, and I asked him about it. He said, oh, I haven't looked at that. I haven't analyzed it, haven't studied it. So I don't know. I'd have to look at that. And of course, we had Jeff Kidd break it down frame by frame, and just the movements couldn't be justified either, you know, based on physics or the evidence in the case. And then we had our Daubert motion, or our motions in limine. Look, we're not going to have any new opinions, judge, here from these experts. So we knew we had him locked in. And so we get to trial, and it was a tough cross-exam. And he ultimately said, you know, on the few frames I showed him, that he could not explain how they could justify that. So you had the expert in conflict with the lawyers, and to tag on to that, you know, I like to lighten things up at trial and have a little fun as well, particularly in a case like this, you've been going 6 days. And so in opening, the lawyer got up and did a pirouette, literally spun around all the way around. And it was on Courtroom View Network. So I told my assistant, I said, get me a copy of that, whatever it costs, get a clip of that. We're going to play it in closing. And everybody was like, you're not going to play that in closing. And I'm like, absolutely, this is a gift. So in closing, after we had destroyed their theory on the evidence, I said, you know, for 6 years, I've been trying to think of something nice I could say about defense counsel. And I said, it occurred to me in opening when he did this, and I played the loop, and we had it looped where he would just keep spinning like a little toy.
Yeah.
And I said, here's what I'm going to say, is he would have made a better ballerina than he would an accident reconstructionist. Oh, wow. And, you know, when the jury laughs, you know you're doing
it. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, and what was that? What was that pirouette about? Was that, why was he doing that?
He was trying to mock our Jeff Kidd's theory on how a mark got left. And it just turned into a real mess. During trial, we came up with a model to really undermine his theory. And he got away from it, and he was scared of it. I would say, what do you think, Shane?
No, I'd say that's definitely it. And, one of the other things that you can do as a spectator in one of Matt Cook's trials, you can start writing down quotes. And his quote about the defense's theory of the wreck was, if all you got's a short-legged pony, I guess that's the one you'll ride.
Wow. That's a good one.
So you guys can use that in future podcasts.
That's right. That's
good. I love that. Well, so did you, I mean, you kind of alluded to this, but did you have, I mean, I guess the skirt team investigated because it was a fatality. I mean, did you just have a workup that was kind of, you know, just not that detailed, or some marks, you know, gouges or whatever that weren't right, or that weren't, or that at least your expert didn't think was right, or were you dealing with a fairly good, I guess, you know, workup by them?
You want to explain for all of our viewers outside or listeners outside of Georgia what the skirt team is?
I always end up saying the, I guess if you say skirt, you shouldn't say team because it means team,
right.
Team, I think.
That's right, yeah.
Specialized collision reconstruction team?
You got it.
That's it.
So you shouldn't say skirt team or else you're saying team. That's but right. Yes, thanks for that reminder, Steve.
So in this case, that's where a lot of the problems originated. It was actually the Gwinnett County has their own reconstruction team there on 85, and they just missed it. I mean, the guy, younger officer who was on the team, gets called out. He's been working 20-something hours straight. He's on I-85, middle of the night, you know, the wreck's at 4:40 a.m. or something. He photographed everything. He marked everything. But he put too much weight on witness testimony. One witness said they're in lane 3, one says he's in lane 4, but he knows the wreck happens in 3. So he says, I don't know who changed lanes. And so case closed. Nobody at fault, no contributing factors, one over the other. And what he missed was the physical evidence in the lanes. You could just sit the expedition right on top of it. And then you could sit the tanker truck on top of the expedition. And that's what he missed. He ultimately came around at trial and said we were right, which is a big thing to admit, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because I think that happens fairly frequently, right? They come in and they're looking for crime. I mean, they're not looking to completely reconstruct an accident the way that we are when it comes to a case and meeting our burden of proof and everything else. What advice do you have for folks on how to deal with that? I mean, fairly early on, you realize that there's stuff that's missed in the report. How did you handle it with him? How'd you handle it in front of the jury? You know, because I assume the defense is trying to use it to undermine your reconstruction.
Well, I think that one of the things that spoke to the jury is kind of a limitation that they expect with governmental entities, and that is budgetary constraints coupled with shutting down a major interstate for a lengthy period of time really just curtailed his investigation, and he wasn't able to complete it altogether. And some of the equipment that CSI has with Jeff Kidd that they did not have, or they did not implement, like a total station mapping of the entire area, was something we were able to do, and it was very telling and very important. One of the things that we discovered when we're sitting down reviewing the evidence is those marks just were so obvious once you got the photograph and really looked at it. And you thought to yourself, wait a minute, if that's an undercarriage mark, like a trailer hitch or some portion of the rear axle, there's no way that Expedition is sitting anywhere but right in the middle of lane three. And so that's kind of where we started. And then if you add to that the yaw marks and the skid marks that go all the way up to where the first resting spot was for the Expedition, it kind of creates a footprint that is unavoidable. And we were able to capitalize on that. And Jeff Kidd really helped us in that respect.
And Yvonne, two things. One point you alluded to there is his mission is different than our mission. In the criminal world, he's looking to see if he can charge somebody with a crime. There's no drugs, no alcohol here, no intent, you know. And so he wasn't going to charge anybody with vehicular homicide in this case. So once he saw that he just couldn't figure it out, he wasn't going to prosecute a case on where there's weak witness statements, he closed his file out and cleared another case off his docket. And our mission, of course, is a little different. The other thing, you know, you ask about the experts, the defense experts' theory. He had an alternative theory. He said that the Expedition drove almost head on into the wheels of the tanker truck. And I've done a lot of products cases like your firm has as well. And there was no damage consistent with it. The black box didn't match that. The fender or the hood was almost pristine. The hood was pristine. The wheels were pristine. And then they came up with a theory about the defendant had taken the wheels off. He told us that he didn't have any pictures of the wheels of the tanker. The trooper or the officer had taken pictures and had produced them in an open records request. And all the pictures except the wheels were produced to the expert. So that put some stink on the lawyers. You know, and what I say about trying cases is I like to find the second insult, you know, meaning, you know, adding insult to injury. That's not just a cliche. And so when they hurt somebody or kill somebody and then they engage in a cover up or underhanded, you know, business, that's a second insult. And you shouldn't be insulting people you've already ran over and hurt. And those are the little things that the jury's looking for. Because right. They all come in thinking lawyers are lying or going to try to slide one on them. And they right. love that stuff. So,
yeah. Yeah, I'm curious, how did the truck driver himself, did he testify, and how did he do on the stand?
Well, as I say, in the longest running project on earth, he had predeceased trial.
Oh, wow.
We deposed okay. him in discovery, and his death was totally unrelated to the wreck or anything. It's just natural consequences. So his deposition was read in by the defense. They did, and Shane made good use of this at trial or in closing. I addressed it, and he followed up on it. But they put the owner of the company also had passed away. So they bring his wife, who's been working with him for 40 years at the company, as essentially the bookkeeper. And she knows nothing. She's designated as the corporate rep at trial. She hasn't read any depositions, hasn't talked to their expert, hadn't heard his theory, hadn't looked at any of the documents, doesn't know where her driver was going, how it happened. All she knows is they're not at fault. She was able to deliver on that one answer. And they go through how she's just a widow and all that. And of course, we were sympathetic to it. And I said it directly to her. Look, ma'am, we're not trying to be mean to you, but you got to answer some questions. And why didn't they send somebody else that's been working at the company for 30 years? Why did they pick you? And of course, they object constantly. But we get down to the case. She never apologizes or said anything. I thought she would. But the defense counsel apologized to our client, who's on the stand. Says, I'm sorry for your loss, Miss Gallo. So I get up and redirect. And I said, have you ever heard a sorry from the company? No. Mm-hmm. You ever heard any expression of guilt now? I said, well, let's pretend that you did get a sympathy card from these folks and you're sitting at home, you know, you've buried your daughter. You're thinking, what are you going to do with your son? How are y'all going to go forward? What's his life going to be about? And you get in the mail a sympathy card from C&T Durham. You open it up you look at it, and I held up my paper to the jury and I said, and here's what it says. Dear Miss Gallo, we're so sorry to hear about the loss of Talia. We're so sorry that we're going to spend $40,000 on an expert who's going to lie and try to screw you. And they're over here protecting, of course, you know. And I said, that's what a sympathy card would say, right? And so in closing, I said, that apology wasn't for her. That apology was for the jury. That was a show. That was for you. Yeah. You know, and Shane followed up on that and really shoved it, you know, where the sun don't shine.
Well, I also wanted to mention one of the ways that they defended this case, and I just want to see what you all, how you handled this. And I'm assuming it was based on something that maybe Mr. Haynes had said to the insurance company when they recorded a statement, but basically that they were not trying to get out of the roadway, that they were hanging around the car. And I think at one point they might've even called them pedestrians, and then said, you know, it was essentially their fault for hanging around in the roadway. What was the basis for that type of argument? And how did y'all handle that?
So, you know, I'm sure you've seen several times, Steve and Yvonne, in the cases that you guys have worked where time takes on a different meaning when big collisions happen. And a lot of times we say things that are representative in the normal course of life as being very short time periods, but in the fast moving elements of a collision, they become very long. And so Stephen Haynes had made a couple of statements, recorded statements to the insurance companies. And one of the things he had said was that they were, I think one time he said they were out in the roadway for 30 seconds or a minute after the first collision and before the second collision. And that's a long time in terms of collisions, but it was really much shorter than that. So they capitalized on his statement and really tried to make it look like Talia and Stephen were just sort of loitering around and hanging out at the car, twiddling their thumbs instead of getting out of the roadway, when the truth was, it was a much quicker process. They were probably in the roadway less than 5 seconds or so, according to what the downloads look like. And that became kind of an important fact, too, because Sandra, as the mother of Talia, had lived, you know, for 7 years thinking that Talia is being accused of being responsible for her own death. And so it was kind of a vindication for her to hear a jury ultimately expressed sentiment afterwards that she had no blame whatsoever for what happened to her. And, you know, ultimately Peyton, when he hears the stories about his mama later on, won't hear that she stood around in the road until somebody ran over her. He'll just understand that she was the unfortunate victim of a terrible, terrible event.
Yeah. I mean, when I read that, I thought, even if it had been truly 30 seconds, you know, you've been in a scary car accident, whatever you are. I mean, you might not be thinking clearly. You might be thinking, I need my purse. You might, you know, like I reading that, you know, and there was reference to that. I just thought, you know, blaming these people for maybe gathering their belongings or not knowing what they should do in between getting hit by two cars, I just thought was really like not a good look. Even if it was that long, I don't think that that's crazy.
Yeah. Shane did a good job, too. You know, the statements were all they had to hang on to, the conflicting, contradictory statements that Stephen Haynes gave. And he gave 3-4 statements. And Shane did a good job with that by not trying to unwind it. We just, you know, from the very first questions in voir dire, you know, we talked about how many of you look at the physical evidence over statements? How many of you have worked at a school and maybe you pull the video rather than listen to what the people tell you or accepting it at face value? You know, you look at things, you know, it's like the rabbit tracks in the snow. You know, sometimes that's better proof than whether or not the night watchman who fell asleep on the porch saw the rabbit come through or not. You know, so we set all that up throughout the case. And then when it came time, Shane handled the redirect of Stephen Haynes, who had his own counsel. He never tried to unwind all that. He just pointed out, you know, you're trying to make sense of it. You saw your cousin die in the road. You had a broke ankle. You almost died yourself, you know, and people understand that. They're forgiven of it, you know, and they would not let the statements go. And it was just so stark, physical evidence and the impossibility of the statements.
You know, one of the things we did too is we kind of planned for how we were going to handle Stephen Haynes and the statements that he had given to the insurance companies. And so we sort of went through a little Miranda type examination of Stephen, getting him to affirm that he had never been told that he didn't have to give a statement. He had never been asked if he had a lawyer. He'd never been offered to consult a lawyer. He had never been told that the statements could be used against him later. And even though we all know that Miranda doesn't really apply in any context of a civil case, it's something that jurors can relate to. So they heard that essentially his Miranda rights had been violated with these statements. And we think that they sort of hung on to that a little bit when they discounted some of the things that the defense were counting on in his statements.
And in closing, I followed up. We split the closing. And in closing, I followed up and I said, you know, this is why people absolutely despise lawyers. They absolutely hate lawyers, because when you're trying to find who's going to be the hairdresser for your daughter at her funeral, and you're trying to give the funeral home some words for the obituary, and you're trying to pick out what outfit she's going to wear, you got lawyers and insurance companies and insurance adjusters plotting your demise. And they get one little statement and they're sitting there ready to pounce, and they want to twist your words and put too much emphasis on it when they know it's not credible. And people were nodding their heads, because, you know, you got to think, what is the, you know, what are our shared values and common beliefs? Mm-hmm. And that's where lawyers get in trouble. They don't keep that in mind when you're talking to a jury. You know, like I cross-examined accident reconstructionist one time, and he said, you know, it's a second and a half perception reaction time. I said, really? How long does it take for a baseball to get from the pitcher's mound to the catcher's mitt? You know, like a third of a second. How does anybody ever hit the ball? You know? So we know the science behind some of it. That's an expected situation, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, the jurors don't just automatically accept everything that lawyers think is fact.
So, Yvonne, the internet is getting more and more crowded, especially ever since the pandemic, and it's getting harder and harder to get noticed online. And you can have all the great verdicts in the world, but if nobody knows about them, then they're not going to come and hire your law firm. So you need to find a company like Digital Law Marketing.
That's right. It turns out that what you put on the internet is no good if people can't find it. And Steve, we've talked about this, but now that I finally know what SEO is, which is search engine optimization, it's really important that your firm's site is maximizing the hits that it's going to get. And something that Digital Law Marketing is doing that's really cool right now is they're offering free SEO audits for law firm campaigns. So that's something our listeners should take advantage of.
Yeah, because it's hard to get around the internet and know how to make yourself visible without having somebody help you. And they are the experts in this. And not only will they help you design your website if you need to, they'll do your content marketing, they'll do your search engine optimization, as Yvonne just said, they'll do your pay-per-click marketing, social media marketing, and they also will offer full management on Google's new local service ads, which we just learned about and are trying to get into. But it's another way that you can put yourself out there and get people to know who you are. And Digital Law Marketing is great at it.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things I think is cool is that you work with them and they really make you feel like they know your firm and they know you, and that they help you with your web presence so that it feels individual. It doesn't feel cookie cutter. It feels like they know the people at your firm and they get what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, it's not like they already have a website done and just give you one that's already been done, but they will spend time with you, get to know your personality, put your personality into the website, and you should go visit them at digitallawmarketing.com. That's digitallawmarketing.com.
Tell them we sent you.
I was just going to ask whether or not Mr. Nomura was called to the stand and what he had to say about it. You had I believe you guys had resolved a case involving him beforehand. Is that right?
Yeah, we had come to an agreement to resolve the case and ultimately took a consent judgment near the end of the case against Mr. Nomura. There was a language barrier throughout the case with Mr. Nomura because he is a native Spanish speaker. And so there was interpreters supplied by the court that worked him through the case and repeated everything that was said, of course. And then when he was called by his counsel to the stand to testify, the language barrier was a little bit difficult to get over, but Mr. Nomura was just very remorseful, very sorry for what had happened. He really couldn't tell a lot about what happened. All of a sudden, he's driving along 85, and this vehicle appears a split second before contact broadside. The electrical components of the car had ceased to operate, so it had absolutely no lights anywhere. And it's 4:40 in the morning between two of the lights of I-85, so it's very dark. And he was just handling a bag of snakes and didn't know what to do. And so he just hit the brakes as quick as he possibly could and didn't know how the vehicle ended up there, didn't know how he could have done anything different. And his contrast for being very, very sorry for what happened and almost tearful about it was pretty stark by comparison to C&T Durham, that's just trying to fabricate a defense. So that's the way that ended up.
Yeah, the first words and the last words out of his mouth on the stand was, "I'm so sorry. I'm very sorry for whatever I did." And that's the only thing he said in English. And it was not rehearsed. It was not coached. I don't think he was capable of being coached. But, you know, I think that was pretty powerful.
I have a very unsexy question. So this is, I've worked on direct action cases before, where when a heavy truck is involved, for people who don't have direct action states or know what I'm talking about, you can name their insurance company as a defendant actually in the caption, which is something you typically can't do. And it looks like y'all did that here, but I'm just curious. I've never had one that went to trial. What happened? What does the jury hear about it, if anything?
Well, typically they try to limit you to qualifying the jury on the insurance, and they want to stipulate away the coverage is in there and you can't even prove that. We didn't allow that. We said, no, we're going to prove it. We had a subpoena and for him to bring documents on the file. So he gets there. And our case is a little different potentially than some direct actions because we had a dispute about the interviews with Stephen Haynes. There were parts missing in the transcript. So we had deposed, Shane had deposed the insurance adjusters and all that. So there was a whole undercurrent that the insurance adjusters had made up a story because they came up with a phantom vehicle story that really was a stretch on an interpretation of at least some of his early statements. So we had that going, but they bring a rep to trial who starts just volunteering a lot of stuff about, well, I've looked at the file and I don't think we've got any responsibility. And I had him on cross. And so it just opened the door to a good bit of stuff for about 25 minutes. We went through that. Well, who have you talked to? And when did you make a decision? And have you talked to the expert? And y'all made a decision early on that it wasn't your fault. Well, do you ever revisit that decision? No, you don't look at what's been shown by our expert or your expert or what the cop has now said, or nope. We make our decision. That's where we roll. So they made themselves, you know, a target in cross, which was to the chagrin of the defense counsel, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, from typically them not hearing anything other than that they get kind of qualified and you have some jurors who maybe get that insurance is involved, to having somebody on the stand like that expressing opinions. Yikes.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the damages part of the case. We've only talked a little bit about Talia, but she was 32 years old, had a 6-year-old son that was Peyton. Talk a little bit about her and how you went about proving up the damages and then you know, what, or if you asked the jury for any verdict during closing.
Sure. We had some really good damages witnesses. We had her preacher and his wife, who gave some pretty stirring testimony about how good of a person she was, how caring she was, and how she went out of her way to help other people. We had her two sisters that were just really sweet girls who did very, very well on the stand and talked about her as a sister and talked about her at different points in time when she was growing up. So we were able to paint a pretty good picture of Talia, we think, and just that she was a good person and a good mother and loved her son very, very much. And that carried a lot of weight. And then when we focused on what we were going to ask for, we really tried to justify it to the jury in a very tangible way that they could kind of hang their hat on it. So we all know in Georgia that the 1949 annuity mortality table is what is admissible, the easiest thing to be admissible in trial. And that is something that's dated back from 1949. People live a whole lot longer, but that gave us 47 years of life expectancy remaining for Talia. And so we took the 47 years and we broke it down into hours, and the hours that it equated to, multiplying it out, we then multiplied that by the $650 per hour of their expert. And that ultimately resulted in a figure of $89 million. And so we compared that to some of the other things that are costs like $89 million. And we talked to the jury about how there are no coincidences, that powers that be, whether it be the good Lord or somebody else, put them in front of us for that case. And it's there. It was a fate that they were going to be hearing this case at this time, and there are no coincidences. So we compared the $89 million of the $650 per hour for the working days, or the 8 hours per day throughout the 47 years of Talia's life, and then talked about a September 2023 crash of an F-35 fighter jet that ultimately costs $89 million. And right before the fighter jet goes down, of course, the radio is telling the pilot, eject, eject, eject. And so we told the jury, look, the reason that they tell the pilot to eject is because the value of his life is more than that aircraft. And so if that aircraft cost $89 million, paying this expert for the remainder of Talia's life costs $89 million, there are no coincidences. And they should award, for the value of her life, $89 million. And we had another little bit of money tagged on to that based on fright, fear, shock of impact, which you guys know are appropriate measures of damages in Georgia for general damages, because there was one statement of a expert that the defense called that said Talia looked up just before the impact with an Amora vehicle, and she had been caught like a deer in the headlights. So we asked for another $1 million for that, and then $5 million for the 5 seconds or so that the evidence indicated she was trying to recover from the initial impact. And so that ultimately totaled $95 million. And when I asked for that, who was later the foreman of the jury openly winced that it was too much. And internally, of course, I'm thinking, uh-oh, I may have gone a little bit too far. But I just looked at him and I said, Talia's life is not worth any less than that at all. And he told me when we talked to the jurors afterward that he said, you know, when you first said that, I was a little bit shaken. I was taken aback and I was a little bit offended. But then he said, I looked over at the defense and I saw what they were doing to y'all. And I saw how bad they were, and I decided I was going to give you every damn penny. And so I felt pretty good about that and just wished he had had the opportunity to help us out in the deliberation room. But that was a pretty good feeling, that it's a big ask, but it was justified in that case.
Yeah. Well, and it's something that, you know, I think we all as lawyers, you know, struggle with is how to ask for money, you know, at the end of the case, because it's not the easiest thing. And for a lot of us, it's actually, you know, for me, fighting on the liability and cross-examining some expert is so much easier than standing up and asking for millions of dollars, you know, just because, you know, so it's it is hard to do.
It really is. And, you know, I'll add this, Steve, that you got to be sincere when you make the ask, because the jury can pick up on doubt. And if you doubt that your case is worth what you're asking for, they're going to pick up on that. Yeah. So you've got to be confident and sincere when you say, hey, this is what this case is worth. And they'll pick up on that, too.
Yeah.
It's really the first time it puts you under the microscope in clear focus. You know, and so I don't like being under the microscope generally. I like to keep it focused on the other side. But, you know, if you've tried your case, you've never misled them anywhere along the way. At the end of the day, they've got to pick somebody to follow.
That's right.
And they give you the benefit of the doubt on that one. You know, that's what you hope.
And you got to lead them. I mean, because otherwise, you know, they hear that, you know, that it's left to their conscience, and most of the jury is going to be like, well, what does that mean? I have no idea what you're asking me to do now. So I think it is absolutely imperative that you at least give them a guide on how to value the case.
And the $650 an hour came from their expert, who was in there doing very mean stuff and being used by somebody to do very mean stuff. And, you know, setting Shane up for the second close, I said, we need more people like Talia. We don't need more people like Mr. Marceau. We need people who volunteer. She's poor. She had nothing. And yet she gave all the time to Veterans Outreach Services, to older people. You know, who does that? Who has nothing yet they give? You know, I said, who is he worth $650 an hour to? What is his time being used for? What is that money being used for? You know, when you start to say, well, you know, here's an insurance company and a big trucking company. They're willing to spend that money. This ain't the only case he has. He said he didn't even know how many cases he had going. More than 100, he said, or more than 90, I think, a year. And you start comparing and contrasting, you know,
mm-hmm.
her versus him. You know?
Yeah.
Peyton absolutely. Versus them. That's the thing that really, I think, justifies it.
Did you ever put Peyton on the stand or have him there in front of the jury?
We did. Our co-counsel who originated the case, Mr. Walter Rucker, is an older gentleman, great, great background, great guy, been practicing probably 55 years maybe. And we had him put him on. And Peyton's now 14. He's still he's a very young 14, though. And it is what it is. We didn't push him to say more. We didn't ask him too much about his mom. You just can't. You cannot look like you're pandering. You can't look like you're torturing this kid through, you know, talking about his mom. So we just put him up maybe 10 or 15 minutes, and I prepped the jury and opened it. I said, look, we're always in a box in a case like this with a kid. I said, number one, I don't want to be accused of pandering to you. That's why I don't like to bring kids. Number two, courtrooms are no places for kids. But I've done it long enough, and I've seen enough juries that some jurors want to see where the money's going. So they gave me an opportunity to make it very clear where the money's going. And I said, Grandma is standing in his place, but we're going to bring him in here for 10 minutes, let you see where it's going. And, you know, we're not looking for sympathy. I made that clear. I said, we're here for money. That's all we're here for, money. Because if they're sitting there thinking about an apology will do some good, you're losing your case. So I don't like talking about money, but you better pretty quickly in a civil jury trial start talking about what they can do. They can't put nobody in jail. They can't bring mama back. You know, they can't hug and hold the little boy every night. They can do some good with some money, and that's what we hear about. So we told them that opening.
Yeah, yeah. So I was wondering the issue with them being out late at night or early in the morning and having been at the club. Did you all handle that in Voir Dire, and how did you kind of take the steam out of that?
Got lucky a little bit more dire. Two people had been to that club. Okay. Two upstanding jurors had been to the club. So that was nice. And right. Of course, you know, defense counsel was like, wait a minute. Oh, you've been there, you know, because they weren't liking that. And then, you know, in opening, I just said, they're going to bring it up. So I stopped and I said, let me get one thing straight right now from the very beginning. They ain't one drop of alcohol and they ain't one fleck of drugs in this case. And they're going to bring up the club to try to hook somebody, to try to appeal to somebody's prejudice or supposition. But they just went there. And I said they went to a reggae club because what was interesting about the case, interesting and tragic, was Sandra Gallo was the mother of Talia. 2 weeks before Talia died, Sandra's other daughter died serving in the military in Hawaii. Oh. So her cousin, Stephen, who's involved in the wreck, has come out from Mississippi, driven 20 hours to attend the funeral. And that's what's going to happen the day after. That's what's planned to happen the day after Talia dies. Oh. So they come out for a wake. It's their tradition. And I said in opening, I said, you know, these are two young people who have always been close. And they spent the day with the family. The funeral's going to be the next day. And just to get away from the heaviness, the sadness, and the darkness that attends a young person's death, they decide to go catch up. And they go to Atlanta, and they spend some time for a couple hours, and they're heading home. And that's what the truth was, and it was pretty terrible. But not one juror said anything about the sympathy for Miss Gallo. They didn't really, I don't think, let that affect them. But you know, it was a fact that came in and was significant, I thought.
Wow, I did not understand that part of the case. That is just terrible for the whole family, but it's, you know, especially for Miss Gallo.
And Shane made the point that I don't want to prolong it, but Shane made the point we had some good damages witnesses, and Sandra did a great job. And we commented on that in closing. She was respectful to defense counsel. He wasn't overtly mean, but I told him in closing, I said, imagine this. You've lost your child. You've heard all of these things said about she killed herself, essentially by getting out of the car and staying in the road. They've made up all this. How do you sit on the stand without one drop of hatred when the lawyer who's promoting all that is asking you questions? How do you do that? You know, it's because she's a reflection of who Talia was. She's not filled with hatred. She's not here to hurt somebody, you know, and that was significant, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, this has been fantastic. We really appreciate your time. I want to make sure, is there anything else about this trial, you know, that you want to make sure that our listeners know about that we haven't had a chance to talk about?
I'll tell you one other little Matt Cook quote that's tidbit in addition to the short.
We need to make a list of all the Matt Cook quotes.
Yeah, this one's very profound, and you guys can probably use it in your next wrongful death case. And that is, in a very solemn way, he just said, you know, one of the last things you ever want in your life is to see one of your children's pictures with an exhibit sticker on it. And a lot of jurors were shaking their head at that one. Mm-hmm. So I got to give him credit for that one as well. It was a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was on law review in law school, but that was a shame. But I also got wittiest in high school. So, you know, it's one award after another, like you say.
That's right. That's right.
I like that because really even our criminal defense attorneys can use that too. I mean, you just don't want your picture as an exhibit to anything.
Yeah, I mean that can be used for a lot. Absolutely.
Yeah.
They can be put on a hat or a t-shirt. For some criminal defendants.
That's right.
Anyway.
That's right. That's right. Well, let me remind everybody who we've been talking to. We've been talking to Matt Cook and Shane Lazenby. Matt, you can look up at cook-lawgroup.com, and Shane, you can look up at lazlawgroup.com. The case we've been talking about is Freeman versus Ace American Insurance Co. and C&T Durham Trucking Co. Et al. And the result was a settlement while the jury was out deliberating. For $10 million, and it sounds like from the conversations with the jury that the verdict was going to be much more than that. But guys, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much. We enjoyed it.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
Thanks, everyone, for listening. It really means a lot to me, Steve, and the Great Trials podcast team. And we have a few people we want to thank, right, Steve?
That's right. Definitely thank our sponsors, Digital Law Marketing. And you can go to digitallawmarketing.com. Who's next, Yvonne?
And then we've got Legal Technology Services, or LTS, and you can look them up at legaltechservice.com.
And then, of course, we don't want to forget Raz and podonthego.com.
Yes. And tell Raz we sent you, but he is our trusty producer and does great work. So feel free to reach out to him if you need help with your podcast.
Hey, we should also thank our law partners because our firm has been very supportive. And that's Harris Lowry Mann. And if you want to look us up, it's at hlmlawfirm.com. And then, of course, we always want you to rate and review us and give a great review if you feel that if that's how you feel. And you can go on and do that at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podbean Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Thanks for listening, guys.